Okay, why don't we go ahead and get started this morning?
So what I would like to do today is to conclude our discussion of discriminative training and actually discriminative adaptation by showing you how we apply these techniques to the adaptation problem. So we'll review these equations that we developed last class, and then we'll talk about some of the practical issues in estimating the parameters of those equations. And then we'll actually extend this to MAP, or we'll show how this is coupled with the MAP concept to produce an adaptation algorithm. And then I'll show you some experimental results that were generated at the time this work was developed, which give you some idea of how these techniques work. I've linked a number of papers here for the lecture. The first four of these are papers that talk about different extensions of the same concept but apply to different adaptation scenarios. There's one on discriminative MAP, there's one on discriminative NPE, the minimum phone error rate, there's one on discriminative training of linear transforms. This last paper, unsupervised training, I'll talk about that next class as we talk about relaxing the restriction from supervised to unsupervised learning. And so we'll spend a little bit of time on that. So you might want to look at that paper before next class just to get some idea what we'll be talking about. Okay, So last time we talked about the fact that discriminative models directly estimate the class posterior probability, and the goal of this approach is to directly minimize the error rate versus maximizing the likelihood of the data given the model, which is what the MLE approaches do. We talked about that there are three general classes of discriminative algorithms: maximum mutual information, which is the one we've been focusing on, minimum classification error, and this hybrid approach, minimum phone or minimum word error rate, MBE, MWE type approach. And our focus here has been on MMIE. And we talked about last time at great length the fact that the MMI classifier design was based on the concept of maximizing the mutual information between the observed data and their corresponding class labels. And we talked about the fact that why that's an appropriate measure for which to train or adapt a model. And then we sketched the outline of the derivation of the re-estimation formulas for the mean and diagonal covariance matrices. We introduced these equations. We have the and these equations are in terms of a couple terms which we're going to make use of this class. So I thought I would just review those. So we have these gamma sub JM. The gammas are the state occupancies. In a hidden Markov model, these are computed by considering all possible paths that go through state J at time t. And that's a computation that's done using the forward-backward algorithm, which is a result of the Baum-Welsh algorithm. If you're not doing a hidden Markov model, these occupancies simply represent the probability of the data given a particular Gaussian. So if you're just looking at, for example, estimation of Gaussian mixture coefficients without the hidden modeling aspect, then these gammas just simplify to the probability that that particular Gaussian produced that particular feature vector. Now the other sort of intermediate variable that we introduced was a parameter we call theta, which is essentially a weighted sample mean. It's a sample mean, but it's weighted with respect to the state occupancies. So the the states that are more likely, the observation vectors associated with those states weigh more heavily into the average, and the average tends to be dominated by those states that are more likely. And we have a term for that associated with the observations, and then we also have a term associated with the square of the observations, because that's essentially the what we need to update the covariance matrix. So we have a contribution for the mean and a contribution for the covariance. The summations are with respect to time, so that we're essentially considering all paths that went through the gamma sub jm are all paths that went through state j at time t, and then we're going to sum over all t to get all paths that essentially go through state j, or mixture component j. Mixture model j. And then the m represents the mixture coefficient. If we have a mixture distribution, then we're going to update each one of those mixture components separately. Now the sum over R we can really ignore, but the sum over R just reflects all, in the HMM formulation, it reflects all states that share these observations in the case that you're using some kind of parameter time, state time, or cluster type approach. So we don't really have to worry too much about the R's for our purposes. So having those intermediate variables, we then form the new value of the mean, the updated or value of the mean, as a ratio of, in the numerator we have these thetas computed over the what's called the numerator, and I'll explain that in a moment, minus theta denominator, plus this d times mu sub jm. So mu sub jm is essentially our prior, our existing estimate of the mean. The theta num we talked about, that's actually this computation done over the maximum likelihood model. So it's essentially it takes into account the probabilities accumulated along with the correct path. The correct path meaning that if we knew what set of states produced the right class assignments for the data, then we can essentially go along that path and accumulate these occupancy probabilities. And then the theta denominator, this represents this computation over all possible paths. Since any state at any time can produce an observation with some probability, we have to essentially sum over all states for all time to get the denominator. The reason we end up with the difference of these is really the result of the fact of two things. One, we're using a law, we formed a posterior, which was essentially the likelihood, the posterior for the likelihood divided by the posterior for the entire space, what we call the evidence. And then we work this problem in the log domain, so we take the log of the ratio, which is just the difference of the logs. So this essentially represents, this difference represents the correct probabilities, if you will, minus the competing probabilities. And that really forms the basis for this correction of the means. Now this is, so you can think of this essentially as another adaptation equation, only it's adaptation in the sense of iterating to drive the maximum likelihood solution high and the discriminative solution, or the competing choices, low. So associated with that we have a term D, which essentially represents an adaptation constant. It's how much weight we give to the prior means. And there's been a lot of study of what to do about this, and I'll comment on that more in a moment. And then we divide by the difference between the state occupancies, plus D. So that's essentially, since the thetas have the state occupancies in them, by dividing by this term, we essentially get a weighted average of this new term, which represents the sample mean, if you will, for the new data plus this prior. So in a moment we'll show how we can apply this to adaptation, but the way this is typically done in MMIE training, you can think of the prior as this is what was determined when you did a maximum likelihood training on the entire training set. And this term then is what happens when you then take those maximum likelihood models and you apply the discriminative training over the same data. So you essentially have the same data being used for both computations, but in this case, we're doing the discriminative computation, and the weighted sum of these two that effectively controls how much weight we give to the maximum likelihood model versus how much weight we give to the discriminative model. The variance adaptation is similar, only here we have these theta of O squareds representing the covariance terms, but the form of the adaptation is the same. We have the and this is actually done in terms of the variance of the prior plus mu squared, the mean squared of the prior. We have then this term, the theta of O squareds for the numerator minus the theta of O squareds for the denominator, which is this is the discriminative part, this is the ML part, and then we divide by this normalizing factor. And then the only other thing is we subtract from this the re-estimated mean. So this is a two-step process. We compute the mean under discriminative training, then we take that mean and we compute the variance under discriminative training. So we can think of discriminative training as a form of adaptation in which the new mean is a weighted combination of the old mean, this mu sub jm, and a difference of the MLE weighted sample mean, which is this numerator term, and the mean of the incorrect choices, which is this denominator term. D is an adaptation constant that is set to ensure that the variance remains positive. So initially when this work was done, the concern was that these variances would become negative, and D was set sort of globally to make sure that all of the variances were positive. The problem with that was giving too much weight to achieve that across all the variances, that was giving too much weight to the priors. So then you weren't getting much benefit out of the adaptation or the discriminative training. So then what was done was to look at trying to make D less aggressive, and so D was made as a function of the mixture component and the state, so D sub JM, and then the D sub JNs were varied as a function of each of the states, and that allowed MMI contributions to have more effect by trying to scale the D to be specific, to still maintain that the variances are positive, but to maintain that those are positive just for that state. Now that's a very similar in thought and thinking to, if you remember when we talked about LMS adaptation, we ended up with this lambda, and lambda was proportional to the maximum eigenvalue. It's a similar kind of situation that you essentially want D to be proportional to the eigenstructure of the covariance matrix, but you want to do that on a per state, per mixture component basis. So we won't say too much about the D sub JMs, but if you read Povey's dissertation, he talks a lot about how they actually estimated those. Okay, so that's sort of where we left off last time, and then I wanted to talk a little bit more about how we actually estimate these numerator and denominator terms. So let's talk about how we estimate the occupancies for the competing hypotheses. So this theta num is the mean of the observation vectors weighted by the occupancies, and theta's denominator is a similar quantity for the incorrect or alternate hypotheses. The essence of discriminative training is to increase the probability of the correct choice, and that's essentially the ML solution. So discriminative training begins after you've done a maximum likelihood estimation. And now the question, the question becomes how you take that ML model and you estimate the errors that it's making and then try to adapt your coefficients to minimize those errors. Now the MCE approach tries to directly minimize the error rates. The MMI approach tries to do this in terms of, as we've discussed, the mutual information. In the early days of discriminative training, people actually tried to do a great sort of simple gradient descent where you would perturb the parameters and then you would measure the error rate. And if the error rate went up, then you would perturb the parameters in the other direction and see if you could sort of, by directly estimating the error rate, you could iterate on the parameters. Now that kind of a solution is actually feasible for small scale problems. And discriminative training is really nothing more than a gradient descent where you're trying to minimize error. So it's perfectly reasonable to do this in a direct way by just taking your parameters, perturbing them by some small amount epsilon, measuring the error rate on some experimental data, and then adjusting epsilon based on whether the errors went up or down. That kind of an approach will actually work. Unfortunately, for large-scale problems, that becomes prohibitively expensive because the process of measuring the error rate for speech recognition, for example, that may take you tens of hours of compute time on a cluster. So you can't, to iterate on this 100 or 1,000 times would be very expensive. So we want a way this can be done with a more of a closed form approach, and that's why we try to set up either a posterior probability or some kind of cost function that we can differentiate. And in the case of the MCE approaches, they set up these discriminant functions that describe the output, sort of describe the decision rules for the output, and then you differentiate those decision functions. In the case of MMI, we're trying to play with the state occupancy probabilities, essentially. So we note the calculation of the Gaussian occupancies, which is nothing more than the probability of being in state J and component M summed over all time, is required. Now, again, if we're not doing a hidden Markov model approach, if you're just trying to estimate the parameters of a Gaussian mixture distribution, for example, directly, and there's no hidden Markov modeling involved, then this becomes a much easier computation because you know that a particular observation is associated with a particular state or a particular Gaussian component, Gaussian mixture component. The problem with most pattern recognition problems is your model has many more your model is not directly observable. So we don't have, when I give you a set of observation vectors and I give you this model, this model you can think of as a black box that has all sorts of internal parameters associated with it, you don't really know how that box was configured to produce those observation vectors, and you don't really care. All that you care about is that box, when trained, can maximize the likelihood of the data given the model. That's what the ML approach is all about. Now, some of this sort of this thinking actually dates back to the late 60s when the hidden Markov models were first being developed. But in the 80s, when neural networks became popular, this was sort of what really pushed the field in this direction, was the concept that you could build a neural network that had some very complicated internal structure And you didn't really care because all you did is you exposed the data to that system, you let the system train or learn about that data, and then you used that system once it was fully trained to do recognition. So this idea that we want a system whose internal states we don't really know about, we don't really care about, we just want the system to learn whatever it needs to learn from the data. So it's very common in most pattern recognition scenarios that your model has internal structure which you don't really know or understand and can't directly observe. Whether it's state 1 or state 2 or state 3 produced the model, you don't really know. Now, it is possible to take your training data and to do significant amounts of analysis on it to try to figure out what's the best internal structure for the model so that the model becomes observable. One of the ways this is done in speech recognition is we will take a sentence and we will have a linguist break that sentence up into words and mark the acoustic waveform in terms of what words were spoken. Then we will have the linguist take those words and map them into phonemes, and we'll then mark the beginning and ends of the phonemes. Then we'll take the phonemes and break those up into states. We usually use 3-state models for each phoneme. So then we'll mark the data by frames so that we know which frame corresponds to which state. And then we could actually train the model so that we know essentially which frames mapped to which states. Okay, now if you do that, you can then directly estimate the parameters of those states by simply, for example, computing a mean over all the frames that were assigned to that state. Now what's the problem with that approach? So that's a fully observable approach, that you're essentially taking the input data and breaking it down so that you know which portions of the data map to which parameters in the model, essentially. Now, what's wrong with that approach? Why is that approach not actually used? Even though you might argue that that approach is optimal because that's making use of all of the knowledge that your linguists have about the problem. Let's say in the case of a speech example. In an image example, the same would be true. You would take the image, you'd break it down into objects, you'd then break those objects down into edges and lines and surfaces, and you know, by the time you were done, you could then have all the pieces of the image that were associated with a rectangle and a polygon, and you could train models for rectangles and polygons. Then you could build images, like you could build objects like trucks and buildings out of those polygons and squares and such, and then you could build the description of the image. This is a picture about a certain city block in a certain location in some city, out of the way the buildings and streets and things are arranged. So you can do the same kind of structural or hierarchical pattern recognition on images or on just about any application. But why don't we go through this process of laboriously labeling the data down to the frame level and making the associations directly with the internal states of the model? Complexity in what sense? Time, right? Very expensive to do that. To do this on audio data, it will typically take us about we measured this to be a process which is about 100 times real time, which means for every second of speech data that you label, you need 100 seconds of human time. So if you want to generate 1,000 hours of data, you need 100,000 hours of human time. And if you think about how much that's going to cost, well, you know, 1,000 hours of human time is probably going to cost you millions of dollars. I mean, 100,000 hours of human time is going to cost you tens of millions of dollars. And that would be for just one data set. So this was actually done many years ago in sort of a landmark experiment in the early 1980s. We created a database which was phonetically labeled, one of the first phonetically labeled databases of its type for conversational telephone speech. Well, actually, no, I take that back. It was for studio recorded, it was phonetically balanced sentences recorded under studio conditions. And we spent about 3 years developing that data, and that data was only several hours worth of data. But when we were done, we had data which was phonetically marked at a very fine precision by some of the leading linguists in the world. So this was, you could say, as good a data as you could get. So, and then we trained, several years later, we trained hidden Markov models on that data. So we trained classifiers on that data, and we got a certain level of performance. Let's say the error rate was 1. We then trained, when we collected this data, we knew what sentences were spoken because we gave people scripts to read. Okay, so we knew the words. We didn't know the phonemes, but we knew the words. So we then trained a hidden Markov model on that data using just the knowledge of the words, just the transcripts. We knew that sentence number 1 had these words in it, sentence number 2. So we did a fully automated training. No humans involved. We saved the millions of dollars that was spent hand marking this data. And what we found is that performance was actually better with that hidden Markov model-based system than the system that we were able to train using the linguist labels. So instead of getting an error rate of 1, we got an error rate of like 0.75, a significant decrease in error rate using completely automated methods. And we tried all the variants. We tried to actually use the linguist markings in the hidden Markov model to try to kind of supervise it and all that. But in the end, what was found was that just by training these fully automatic methods, hidden modeling methods on that data, we got better performance. So this is one of the reasons why the hidden modeling techniques are really preferred, because they tend to do very well. They can learn about the data very powerfully. And they aren't subject to the labor-intensive nature of creating data in such a way that you have a fully observable model. You know which states map to which frames. Now, so that's a good thing, but that creates this problem that in your model, for any given piece of data, you don't know exactly what states were exercised in that model for that particular data. So we have to infer that, and that's really what makes things like this MMI training, it's what makes it work, but it also is what makes it a challenge, and it's why we use technologies like hidden Markov models, so that in the process of training, we can actually infer, if you will, what internal states map to what data. So to do this, we need to do this computation, and the complicating factor is that we don't know which states correspond to which frame. So we have to somehow infer that during the training process. Now, getting the correct states, that's actually something that's not too hard to do. If you have any kind of background in communication theory, you may be familiar with concepts like the Turby decoding. And getting the correct model at the correct states is actually not too bad. You can take the data, you can recognize it with the model, and you can choose the best path through the model, the sequence of states that is most likely to explain the data. And then you can consider that sequence of states as the correct choice, if you will. And then you can use the occupancies associated with those states for the MMI training. So if all we had to do was to get the correct model, that wouldn't be a problem because we can use concepts like Viterbi decoding. The problem is getting the computations for the competing models, because that essentially requires summing over all possible ways the data could have been generated. So the latter is expensive, this computing the competing models, and it's been the subject of much research. For problems not involving hidden modeling, as we've discussed, you can do direct estimation of the parameters. And the correct state can be the individual state that's most likely, and that's called the Turby decoding, and the incorrect states are simply all other states. Further, for small-scale problems, for example, if you're building a four-state classifier, and all you really have are four Gaussian mixture models representing each one of your classes. You can do this exhaustively because you know that if state number one is the correct state, then states two, three, and four become the incorrect states, and you can essentially do a very simple calculation. However, for large-scale problems, the number of incorrect choices is an extremely large, almost unlimited space, and calculation of these occupancies using a closed-form solution is prohibited. For example, in a speech recognizer, we may have 8,000 or 10,000 states. So you have a 10,000 factorial problem, because essentially the model allows any of those states to be mapped to any observation vector. So a 10,000 factorial is just something you cannot compute. Even it's not feasible, even with today's computers. So what we do instead, we borrow from some concepts that were developed many years ago in communication theory. We use some decoding approaches. The two primary approaches are what are called NBESLIS and lattices. We need a method of generating all possible state sequences or explanations of the data. But when I say all possible, I mean really, we can't generate all possible because that's a 10,000 factorial problem. But what we can do is we can generate the most likely. But we want the most likely to be some fraction of the complete space. It's got to be a very small fraction of the complete space, but it should be a significantly larger fraction than the one best hypothesis. So there's two methods of doing this, NBESLIS and lattices. We'll talk mostly about lattices today, but NBESLIS are produced using a stack decoding type approach in which the n most likely explanations of the observation sequences are produced. For maximum likelihood estimation, n can be small, on the order of 100. For discriminative training, n should be very large, 1,000 or more. The NBEST approach, if you've had some background in search techniques in artificial intelligence or in communication theory, this is essentially a depth-first algorithm. What you simply do, it's a suboptimal approach to searching a network, and what you simply do is you start at the beginning of the network and you take one step forward, you look at all the alternatives, you keep maybe 1,000 of the most probable, and then you take another step and you extend those 1,000 most probable hypotheses. And you just continue on this way until what you end up with, the overall 1,000 or so that are most probable. Now there's a whole theory behind that, we won't go into that in this class, but what's important to understand, what comes out of this for a sequential pattern recognition problem are the n most likely explanations of the data. So in the case of a speech recognition system, this will be n sentences, sequences of words, that describe what was most likely spoken. So, for example, if the sentence is something like, my car is red, many of the top choices are explanations of the data that are very similar, but they differ in some of the words that are difficult to recognize, like articles. So instead of the, you might have instead of nouns like red, you might have some words that sound like that. So, I don't know, bread, dead, you know, etc. And then depending on how your language model works, sometimes you can throw out some of those implausible choices, but sometimes they're left in. Now, you can actually see this in operation when you watch closed captioning systems on TV, if you've ever watched how these operate in real time. Sometimes you'll see, as a person's speaking, they spit out a caption, and they're generating the best sequence of words in real time. But then often you'll see they'll go back and actually change that very quickly, because what's happened is, in the process of while the person's speaking, they're outputting what are the current best choices for the for the hypothesis. But then when they're finished, they go back and they take the decoder actually outputs these n choices, they go back and they re-rank these N choices using more sophisticated grammatical constraints and semantic constraints and things, and then they may produce a different choice as the overall best hypothesis, and then they go back and they update what they output. You can see this in this is really fun to watch when you're using a dictation system. If you've ever used one of these computer dictation systems, it'll output all sorts of crazy words, but then once you hit a sentence boundary, it'll go back and it'll correct the sentence. And this is one of the ways spelling corrections, for example, are done. Because once you've finished the sentence, it can do a better job of figuring out what the right spelling for words which have multiple spellings but sound the same. For example, read versus read and things like that. So this was one of the two major decoding techniques, and actually dates back to the late 60s when they were using this for decoding bit sequences in communication systems. Lattices, on the other hand, are a representation of the hypothesis space in which the start and stop times of individual symbols are arranged in a connected graph, and candidates are output if they exceed some candidate symbols are output if they exceed some preset likelihood threshold. So here we have an example of these are all the different words that were output at different points in time by the system. And the goal of the recognizer then is to go through this is an intermediate output, to go through this output and find the overall best path, and that's what the recognizer will output as the best sequential pattern, the best sentence, in the case of a speech recognition example. So this is, you can think of this as an intermediate representation because this contains all plausible paths, one of which is the overall best, the maximum likelihood solution. But all the other paths are essentially the competing hypotheses. And this is a very convenient and important representation because it allows us for the MMI training to go and compute the occupancies for the competing hypotheses. Now, there's a little bit of a catch with this. Initially, when this work was first done, the process of generating the overall best choice, let's say that ran 100 times real time, which meant for 1 second you needed 100 seconds of compute time. And that was a common, in the early days of this work, our state-of-the-art systems were running about 300 to 500 times real time, just for the one best hypothesis. Now, to generate the lattice, it was taking 2 to 3 orders of magnitude more than that. So instead of taking 100 seconds or 500 seconds per second of speech, it was taking 50,000 or 100,000 seconds per second of speech. So lattice generation used to run for, you know, for example, a month, whereas your one best experiment would run maybe in a night. And in fact, the first, I remember at the time people presented the first MMI results, they spent one month of clock time meaning, you know, real time, calendar days, 1 month, generating the lattices to get their first MMI results. They actually used, they ran that on 10 processors or so. They used a year's worth of compute time just to get the lattices. And on top of all that, each of the lattices were several gigabytes. We didn't know a lot about compression in those days. Each of the lattices were several gigabytes per file. So you had maybe 1 megabyte of audio data, and you had to generate a 2 gigabyte lattice to be able to do the MMI calculations. So if you had hundreds of thousands of utterances to be evaluated, you needed, you know, hundreds of gigabytes of data. Now, the interesting thing is, in 1980s, that was a big deal. In the mid-1980s, we didn't have large amounts of disk space like we have today. Today, that doesn't seem so large because you can buy a terabyte disk and that sits in a little box. I just bought one of these. And, you know, you have a lot more disk space. But in those days, that was a big issue. Now, since then, we figured out ways to compress the lattices and such. But it's really important that the lattices be deep, because you're trying to estimate to get the MMI to have a great effect, you're trying to estimate the competing choices. You need to know the states that were most likely to cause errors. So you have to dig pretty deep into the lattice to get those. So you couldn't simply use a small lattice. You needed a lattice which was fairly deep, fairly big, and had lots of rich information about not just the best path, but all possible paths that could cause confusions with the best path. Because what you're going to do then is to essentially try to increase the occupancies for the best path and decrease the occupancies for the incorrect paths. Now, the other important thing here is that, okay, so now we have a lattice which gives us all possible ways the data could be explained. It's still actually a very small fraction. It's nowhere near the 10,000 factorial that we talked about. But maybe, if you're lucky, this covers, I don't know, a tenth of 1% of the possible alternatives, which is still a lot. Whereas the one best path is one path out of billions and billions and billions of alternatives. But to now know the one best path, we need to know the transcription of the data. To be able to compute the ML solution for the correct choice, we need to know what the correct choice is. That may seem obvious. But think about that from an adaptation standpoint. This means when you collect the adaptation data, so for example, you pick up your cell phone and you want the system to start adapting to you, you can't do that. Because you don't know, the system doesn't know what words you were speaking. So typically what was done for this kind of data was we used data for which we had transcriptions. We used small amounts of data for which we had transcriptions. So in the experiments we'll see in a moment, the small amount of data constitutes 40 hours of adaptation data. And 40 hours to transcribe 40 hours of adaptation data is a lot of work. So this is, as we've presented it thus far, this is a supervised learning method because it needs to know the answer to do the adaptation. That's significantly different than all other techniques we've talked about. And it's important to understand that distinction. Now, next class, I'll talk about some recent work that's been published that tries to relax this assumption. And I'll also talk at the end of class today about one way we can get around this that actually is surprisingly effective. Now, fortunately, unfortunately, this is an error. So fortunately, the occupancies, this last sentence has an error in it, the occupancies for gamma denominator, that's a very important distinction, now can be computed by simply summing occupancies across the whole lattice. So that problem gets easier. We can actually now compute the denominator term because we have essentially all possible alternatives. Now, again, this is still a small fraction of the space, but the idea is that the probabilities drop sort of exponentially. So after you've gotten the first, let's say, 1,000 alternate states or 10,000 alternate states, the other ones have such low probabilities they won't really factor into the calculations. So typically you'll find that if you generate the lattices in line with what I was saying, the additional states are coming in at such low probabilities that the portion of the summations that you're missing to all these other states are negligible. Because after the first so many, the distributions drop off pretty quickly. Now, lest you think, well, this is all silly, obvious, or some combination of the two, these kinds of details can actually cause your experiments to fail. And you see this time and time again in fields like speech recognition. The theory is, you get some good idea, you derive some equations, but to actually implement the theory, you have to take care of a lot of practical details. And if you mess up any one of those practical details, you get a bad experimental result. And then you think, well, the theory was no good, and you discard it. Theory could have been good, it's just you could have missed some of the practical details. So having this kind of insight doesn't come automatically. This comes from working in the application space for many years and understanding how you can work around some of these drawbacks. And very often, it's pretty common in most fields that when someone makes a theoretical advance, it takes, even at the fast pace we work at today, it takes 2 or 3 years for people to completely understand how to implement that thing properly. So the first MMI experiments were very unimpressive, but over time, we got better and better at it. And that's generally what happens with almost any technique. There's a time that it takes for the technique to mature. And when you're doing your dissertations, for example, it's very likely that your main results for your dissertations will not be the matured results. Those are very preliminary results. So you may have a good idea for your dissertation, you may run your initial experiments, and they may be negative. Well, does that mean you stop your dissertation and you go to a different topic? No, but on the other hand, you don't have 3 more years to spend getting those experiments correct. So with a dissertation, that's one of the reasons why it's very important to have a good, strong theoretical basis for your dissertation. So that even if the experiments are not encouraging, if the theoretical base is there, you can sort of say, well, you know, it looks promising, but we haven't figured out all the practical details yet. The practical details make or break the experimental results. You can't get good experimental results on real problems unless you take care of all these practical details. But you as a graduate student may not have enough experience to know all those practical details. And you may not be in a research group that has other people who have that knowledge. So this kind of work you'll very often see being done by groups that are at the forefront of state-of-the-art research in this area and have many, many people in the group who can help the graduate students get the experiments right. Because you're talking about years and years of software development to be able to run, add this kind of a feature to a recognition system and get a correct result. Okay, so hopefully that makes the discriminative training part a little clearer. Now, what I wanted to do next, the second major topic today, is to now extend this to sort of make this a formal adaptation technique by integrating this into our MAP approach. So now what we want to do is we want to combine MMI and MAP for adaptation. So I'll begin by asking a question. Well, why do we introduce MAP into MMIE? So you now have this new discriminative training approach, but we haven't really established this approach as an adaptation technique. So what are the different ways we could apply this to adaptation, to the adaptation problem, and why would we want to introduce it in a MAP framework? And that's a much harder question, especially if you're not really comfortable yet with MAP. So what is the difference between ML and MAP? That's something you should know. Discussed it now for a while. What is the primary difference between the MAP approach and the ML approach?
The ML assume equal priors. The MAP assume some kind of distribution.
Right. And why are techniques like MAP so important to the adaptation problem? Why not just use ML to do adaptation?
Okay. Get some information about the application problem. Some prior
is as prior. And why do we need to use prior information for adaptation?
To get better resources.
Why? That's absolutely right. You're doing great, 100% so far. Just got to finish it.
Got one little connection to make.
What is the nature of the adaptation problem? If you had to describe the adaptation problem in a general form to me, how would you describe it? And what makes the adaptation problem different from the ML problem? So that's a very high-level question that any of you should be able to answer since you've been in an adaptation course now for like three-quarters of the semester. What is the adaptation problem? It's always nice to take a course, we're three-quarters of the way into the course, and now we'll start formally asking what's the course all about. Can our remote guys answer that one? What is the essence of the adaptation problem? I know they know the answer because they're actually working on a system that has this problem. What makes the adaptation problem? Your comments about priors are absolutely correct. With MAP, we make use of prior information in a very controlled way. But let's remember, why do we want to make use of that prior information? Yes? Right, but we could just take our new information and our prior information and mix it together in an ML solution. So what is sort of the unique aspect of the adaptation problem? It's simple, it's obvious. I know you all know it, you're just not connecting it. Right, so we can take our prior information, we can take our new data set, we can mix them together and just do an ML estimate. That's what we call the ML approach. Why do we not... What is sort of unique about the adaptation problem? And you guys out there know the answer because you were telling me about what happens when it's raining out all of a sudden or, you know, these kinds of things. Are we allowed infinite amounts of adaptation data? What would happen if I gave you this cell phone and I told you this is beautiful? It will get 100% speech recognition accuracy. All you have to do is take it home and train it for 4 years. Talk continuously into it for 4 years, and at the end of those 4 years, I guarantee you, you'll get 100% speech recognition accuracy. And you say, well, why do I need to talk into it 4 years? And I, of course, here I am at Radio Shack explaining this to you, that, well, you know, we use hidden Markov models, and there are 6 billion parameters associated with those hidden Markov models. And I need 10 data points per parameter. So if you do the multiplication, that works out to 4 years of audio data that you need to collect. Now, are you going to buy this phone? What?
Absolutely not.
In fact, this experiment was done in the commercial marketplace. Do you remember dictation systems? I know you all were probably a little bit young when they first hit the market. The first dictation systems required several hours of training data. And they were a failure in the marketplace because the people they tried to sell them to said, I'm too busy to sit down and talk to my computer and train it for several hours. Even when those systems required only 20 minutes of data, they were still prohibitive for some users. One of the target groups were doctors, and doctors say, I'm busy. That 20 minutes is the time I can see a patient. I'm not going to spend 20 minutes talking to my computer. So then we learned how to do unsupervised adaptation so that it could train as you're using it, but you never really knew that. So what's the essence of the adaptation problem? The essence of the adaptation problem is that we have a small amount of new data. And that's purposeful because we don't want to require large amounts of new data for adaptation. Preferably, we would like a small amount of unsupervised data, meaning a small amount of data for which we do not know the answers. You would like your cell phone to adapt within seconds of speaking to it. And there are algorithms that can do that. They don't work as well. So why introduce MAP into MMI? Well, MAP is unavoidable because we have to leverage prior knowledge. And the way we leverage prior knowledge is to use a model of the priors. So we now want to kind of combine these two. Well, the way that's done is to set up an objective function, which is no longer just a ratio of the correct probability to the incorrect probability. And we show this in the log space so that we have the log of the prob minus the log of the prob. In the prob space, this is just the product, or this is just the ratio. But in the log prob space, this is just the difference. But we add to that the prior. And the neat thing about this within the MMI context is this just is an additive term. So we can leverage a lot of what we've already learned. But this is going to be a prior on the model parameters, as we've talked about. And this leads to an auxiliary function of the form. Now, I'm skipping a few steps here because we didn't really go through the discriminative training application. But I wanted to talk about this briefly because it gives you some insight into how the solution was arrived at. We have essentially models for the likelihood of the correct choice, the likelihood of the log likelihood of the incorrect choices, and we have the prior. But the derivation of the MMI derivation also introduces a smoothing term, which is called G superscript SM. This term was introduced to help facilitate this optimization. This is kind of an interesting concept. It's called iSmoothing, the particular approach that they chose. If you have a function, I guess I can draw on the screen, right?
Yes.
If I press, I think that guy, right? I think I pressed the wrong guy, but.
Just push what color you want to use.
Push what? I pressed that thing, which is probably not the right thing. So this is kind of interesting. The idea is if you have a function which is kind of noisy, if you try to find the optimum of this function, what's likely to happen?
What's your optimum?
Well, suppose you want to find the critical points of this function. You're going to differentiate it, right? But we've talked about the fact that quadratic functions are nice because they have a very clear single optimum. In reality, these functions are in a multidimensional space and they're rather noisy. So if you differentiate this, you're going to get stuck, potentially stuck at all these local optimum. So this smoothing concept, which is really, I think, very creative, is you add to this some kind of smooth function so that the function that you optimize still gives you the same solution, the same optimal solution, but it essentially smooths out this space so that you're more likely to achieve an to achieve the correct solution rather than getting stuck in these local optimum. And that's why they call it actually eye smoothing. We alluded to that yesterday, and that's a result of adding this term to the optimization. And this term is actually it's introduced in a way that they make it look like a log prior, so that it fits very nicely with the notion of the map solution. So we've got this function. The form of the prior used in this is a map, is a product of Gaussians. We essentially postulate Gaussian distributions for all of the unknown parameters, and when we're doing this in a log space, you have a product of Gaussians, but in a log space that gives you a sum of the arguments of the exponential. So what you end up with in that case is a sum of, for each one of these terms, you get this kind of a distribution, which is essentially here, we've got the constant term associated with the Gaussian plus the quadratic term, but then you have the sum of these, because with the log prior you had the product of the Gaussians. So I don't want to dwell too much on this other than to say that the form of the prior that we use is again going to be a Gaussian prior. And that's nice, because when you put all these together, you can relate them in terms of the variances and the means of these Gaussian distributions. And then in addition, when they do introduce this smoothing, they also introduce the smoothing function is in the form of this log prior, so that everything kind of works out nicely in terms of the standard map derivation that we're used to seeing, where you're trying to optimize the parameters of this Gaussian distribution. So the process of inserting this smoothing function and modeling it as a log prior is referred to eye smoothing, and the essential parameter associated with that is this term we'll call tau sub I, tau superscript I, and this represents the likelihood of the adaptation data given the ML model, or this what we call the numerator term. Under these assumptions, the components of our MMIE re-estimation equations actually have a very simple modification to them. To take into account the prior, the state occupancies are simply modified by adding this term tau sub I, tau superscript I, which is essentially, these are probabilities, remember, and this is just essentially it's the likelihood of the adaptation data given the ML model. It actually turns out just to be a constant that we set that controls, it essentially adds additional strength to the ML model. It strengthens, if you will, the impact of the prior information. And then these theta terms are also modified in a similar way, where we have the state occupancies plus tau over the state occupancy. So the more you increase tau, the smaller you make tau, the more you rely on the original ML model, and the larger you make tau, the more weight you're giving to the discrimination model. So all that's done then is, with this simple modification of these terms, we can go back to the discriminative re-estimates of the mean and variance, only the thetas here are going to be these theta primes, and these theta primes have this term tau associated with them. So the MMI map approach integrates the prior knowledge of the parameters, ML estimates from the training data, and the MMI map estimates from the adaptation data. Typically this tau superscript I is set to 100, while the map adaptation constant is often set to 10. So this shows you we give significant weight, to get this algorithm to have effect, we give significant weight to the MMI information. Now, obviously I've skipped the derivation, but I just wanted to show this, to show you that to actually combine MMI and MAP, it has a fairly simple interpretation in terms of an adaptation constant that you simply add to these numerator terms. And by varying that constant, you can essentially control how much emphasis you give on the discriminative training part. And so the solution is very consistent with what we saw for our MAP adaptation, in that we have a mixing parameter. So let's spend the remaining time talking about an example of how this was originally applied to a speech recognition problem. So we now have essentially three tools at our disposal. We have maximum likelihood, we have MAP, and we have MMI. And these can be mixed and matched in several interesting ways. So the only real way to find out which works best is to do some experiments. So what this graph shows is a set of experiments. These were some of the first experiments done with this approach. We took 100 hours of telephone data. This was data collected with people talking over standard wired telephone lines. And we built models on that data. Those models represent essentially the ML models. And then we asked the question, how difficult would it be to adapt those models to a new domain? The new domain that was chosen is a voicemail application where people were calling other people and leaving voicemail messages. Now, this is not an extreme adaptation scenario because people are still talking primarily over the telephone, and what has mainly changed in this application is the style of speech. The original data was collected with people talking in a conversational, very relaxed way, friends talking to friends over the telephone. In the voicemail sense, you know, people talk differently. They leave informational messages and things like that. So there's different kinds of adaptation that could be done. There's acoustic adaptation, where we try to take into account whatever changes there are in the recording environments, the sound of the data, that kind of thing. And then there's also a language model or domain adaptation, where we try to take into account the fact that words and phrase probabilities are going to change from conversational speech, where you're talking to friends about, you know, usual kind of stuff, to voicemail, where you're leaving, you know, different kind of sentences, different kind of word choices, etc. In this set of experiments, the focus was on the acoustic part of the problem. But it turns out on this problem, the language model adaptation actually gives you a lot more mileage. But here we're talking just about acoustic adaptation. And we took, for adaptation data, we took from 0 to 30 hours of data. So that's a fairly large amount of adaptation data, actually. And all that data was transcribed, so we knew what words were spoken by the users. That was all that had to be done. So we start with 100 hours of data from domain A. We have an additional 30 hours of data from domain B. And now the question is, how can you mix these two so that you get the overall best system after you've trained on both sets of data? Okay? So is that clear? The problem, the challenge is 100 hours of data on condition A, 30 hours of data on condition B. Do whatever you want to do, but at the end of that, give me your best system. Okay? Well, what's the obvious thing to do? The obvious thing to do before you ever came to this class was to put the data together, make it 130 hours of data, A plus B, and simply train an ML solution. Right. And the performance of we sort of know that we can do better than that. I mean, at the time this work was done, the map adaptation solution was also mature. So then the next step would be, let's take the 100 hours of data, treat that as the priors, and do map adaptation on the additional 30 hours of data. And that's essentially what this ML map is. This is the traditional map approach that we've discussed. Start with your maximum likelihood models as priors, adapt them using the maximum likelihood map approach. And that takes you from an error rate of 51% down to an error rate of about 45% with 30 hours of adaptation data. Now, at the time this work was done, these error rates were considered state-of-the-art. I mean, that's still pretty bad performance. A 50% error rate means you're missing every other word. That's not good. But at the time this work was done, this was considered state-of-the-art. However, what's even more interesting, and one of the reasons why I never got excited about adaptation work, 51% to 45%, that's not a whole lot of improvement. That's 6% absolute on 50% of an error rate. That's just about 10% of your error rate. It's a 10% improvement of your error rate. So these are the kinds of small improvements people chase in this field. In fact, after years of research, we got these error rates down to like 20%. At 20%, adaptation was making a difference of maybe 1%. And, you know, look at all the theory, all the work, all the experiments to get that much. So these are small improvements. But the reason I like this plot is it shows you how these different techniques compare. So the next option is to do ML training and then to do the MMI map approach that we just finished discussing. And that's the square boxes here, and that goes from 51% down to about 43%. Well, one thing that we always enjoy about speech research is people are very good at what we call knob turning. So with all these different combinations, people are very quick to try all the different combinations and see if they can find something that works really well. So the next choice you might say is, well, let's use MMI, let's train discriminatively. That should do better than ML. And you can see, in fact, that the MMI trained models give you about a 3% improvement, or about a 2% improvement over the ML models. And then let's do map adaptation on those. So those are the circles, and if you see that, if you look at that error rate, that also, it starts out better than the ML-based training. So MMI is better than ML, but you lose the advantage as you're able to adapt the ML approaches. You lose, to some extent, the advantage of the MMI. You have the MMI map, the MMI training followed by map adaptation, and ML training followed by MMI adaptation give you about the same result. So that's actually satisfying, that these two converge to about the same point, whether you do ML first and MMI second, or MMI first and ML second. But of course, the real thing that we're after is MMI training and MMI adaptation. And when we do that, we get the last curve, which starts at 47% and goes down to about 41%. So doing MMI training and MMI adaptation, we get about 1% better than doing the MMI and MAP, doing ML and MMI. And we get about 4.5% better than doing everything with just ML and MAP. And that was considered significant. It's actually statistically significant for this data set. So people naturally got very excited about the MMI-based adaptation. But remember, this is hours of data, and there's not many applications for which that's a good model. So a lot of research has been done over the years in trying to get these kinds of results at much smaller amounts of adaptation data. Okay, that's it. So we'll pick this up on Tuesday.